If you can't take your eyes off the news for long these days, you are by no means alone. And it's not just about the news from home. All around the world, countries seem to be rubbing each other the wrong ways. Our next guest watches the action with keen interest. Richard Haass is the president of the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of A World in Disarray, now released in paperback. Richard Haass, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
You've been making the rounds of the media lately, and it seems like even the interviews are not moving coming fast enough to keep up with events. I mean, how much did you have to add to the book for the new edition, the paperback edition?
Quite a lot, because it had to cover the first year of Mr. Trump. And whatever else you may think about him, he has been a consequential and a busy president. So it took 5,000 words.
You tweeted a few days ago that this is a truly dangerous moment in history. Is that just about Donald Trump, or is that about other people in the world as well?
I think it's fair to say that he inherited a dangerous situation. You have North Korea on the verge of putting nuclear warheads on missiles that could reach the United States. You had a Russia that had already used force in Ukraine and used it in Syria. You had a totally unregulated cyberspace. You had Venezuela unraveling. The Middle East has more fault lines than Southern California. So, I think that was the case that Mr. Trump inherited. And what he's done now is added to it with a degree of unpredictability and unreliability and taking the United States out of all sorts of global efforts to deal with some challenges. So the answer was it was a dangerous situation. It was a world in disarray, to use my word. And now it's become, I think, considerably more worrisome.
So when you talk about a world in disarray, and when you describe this as a truly dangerous moment in history, I noticed that the tweetbacks were heavy on blame for Barack Obama. So, I mean, let's go there. When the situation that you talked about in the hardback edition a year ago, how much of that was attributable to Barack Obama and how much to just other actors and countries in the world?
I think the baseline is it's contributed to certain things like the rise of China, the crankiness of a Russia, the fact that a lot of the post-World War II institutions hadn't kept up with the world and were increasingly inadequate because of globalization, a lot of challenges that couldn't be met. So I think that's the backdrop. Then you had George W. Bush do the Iraq War, and I think that really scrambled the Middle East in bad ways. Barack Obama was unwilling to use force in many cases, whether it was to keep forces in Iraq or leave them in Afghanistan without a time limit on them. Obviously, he didn't honor the red line in Syria. So he raised questions about American reliability. And I think that Donald Trump has come in, and whatever problems he inherited from both Bush and Obama, again, he has compounded them significantly.
Richard Haass, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations. His book is A World in Disarray, American Foreign Policy and the Crisis of the Old Order, now in paperback. You can join us at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's step out of today's news. Your introduction takes us back to the back-to-back highs of the Berlin Wall coming down in 1989 and the routing of Saddam Hussein's Iraq and Kuwait 14 months later. Where did all the good feelings go?
Yes, that was the New World Order moment, and it looked as though the world had come together. Look, I think what happened was, first of all, in the case of Saddam Hussein and Kuwait, that was a challenge to the one principle that most countries could agree to, which was countries should not invade other countries. Just simply because they agreed on that and this rather egregious exhibition of militarism by Saddam, one shouldn't assume that they agreed on much else. And then with the end of the Cold War, that was fine. Obviously, it was good. It was on our terms. But ultimately, you had the increasing alienation of Russia under its under Putin. So it was unlikely to last. History doesn't stop. The whole idea that you have an end to history to go along with the popular idea of the moment is ludicrous. You always have new challenges and new forces. And in some ways, it was probably predictable in that the Cold War was a very structured period of history. You woke up every morning and you kind of knew who was playing for your team and who was opposing it. And then we suddenly moved to a much more fluid period of history, and it created much more space and opportunity for all sorts of forces to become more active. And because of modern technology, they increasingly had the means to do so.
Is that fluidity more the norm than that that period of stability we had after the Second World War?
I think you're right, it is. And I think what we're in now is more typical. The Cold War, that kind of rigid, that existed, alliances for four decades, that froze a lot of international relations. The United States and the Soviet Union had an outsized influence over a lot of countries in the world. That, to me, is a somewhat atypical or abnormal moment. I think now, where you're seeing a lot more independent action, is probably a more typical and also more difficult to control moment of history.
You mentioned technological changes in the world, and I haven't yet talked about one that certainly changes in the way that people reach each other and are able to talk to each other, and that's the Internet. I mean, how big a factor is just the presence of the Internet in international relations now?
I think it's an enormous factor in all sorts of ways. I mean, obviously, for commerce, it's a big factor for communications, the flow of ideas, the flow of the ability to see things halfway around the world instantly. It's also the way, as we've seen, it's a training, it's a recruiting tool for terrorists. It can become a way to move resources across the world, and the causes or purposes can be quite nefarious. So the Internet is this large new domain that has emerged, and it's virtually, it's like the Wild West. And by that I mean you've got a lot of people out there with guns, and there's no sheriff. It's essentially unregulated, and so Russia could do what it did during the American campaign. You have groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda recruiting and inspiring over it. It's obviously central to the functioning of our banking system, our economy. We all like to email. We all like to go on social media. So it has all these purposes. And again, the rules have lagged significantly behind the reality.
Richard Haass, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations. He's the author of the book, A World in Disarray, now out in paperback, subtitled American Foreign Policy and the Crisis of the Old Order. You can join our conversation on the exchange as we talk about the world that is quite different from just a few years ago. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. As the Cold War ended, I can't imagine it was that abrupt that nobody really was thinking about what would come next in terms of a world structure. But in hindsight, it certainly looks that way at this point, Richard.
Well, I remember at the time I was at the White House as the Cold War came to an end. I was working for George Bush, the father. The president was on the optimistic side, saying that with the end of the Cold War, we could probably work things out within the Soviet Union, soon to become Russia. He had kept U.S.-Chinese relations on a pretty even keel, despite the repression at Tiananmen Square. You had just seen the world come together to deal with Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait. So I think there was some optimism. At the same time, the CIA was warning that as the structure and stability of the Cold War disappeared, we shouldn't assume that it would be stable, that a lot of new forces would begin to fill things. My own view was simply that whatever was going to happen, it wasn't going to happen by itself. There, nothing in history is inevitable, and I thought that ultimately a lot would matter what the United States did and didn't do, and how well we worked. We were able to coordinate or work out relations with the Soviet Union or Russia, with the rise in China, with India. That I thought that would all matter to a significant degree. So I was neither an optimist or a pessimist. My own sense was, again, that history is there's very little about history that's baked into the cake that's inevitable. So I thought we had a lot of influence over how history would play out.
Not optimist or pessimist, perhaps, but would you consider yourself a realist like Brent Scowcroft, who was the National Security Advisor in the administration in which you worked?
Absolutely, and he remains one of my closest friends, and I'd say in that sense very much so, and a lot flows from that just in terms of one's understanding about how history plays out. And I think Brent would agree that one shouldn't assume the worst or the best, and that, again, American foreign policy at this era of history is as much probably has more influence than any other single factor. And again, what worries me a little bit about the current situation is I think we're not using our potential influence nearly as much as we should, or certainly not in the right ways. And as a result, the world that's likely to emerge is going to be far messier, far more disorderly. And I think we as Americans will pay a price for that.
Where do you think that potential influence could be best applied? Where is the place or with the people with whom it would have the greatest leverage?
Well, if I could choose a few things that I'd do differently, I would basically, you know, have the United States re-enter the Trans-Pacific Partnership. This is an economic agreement that will govern, what, 40% of the world's economies right now in terms of the output. So I think that would make a big difference there, and it would also push back against China in some useful ways. I would be sitting down with North Korea to try to negotiate an acceptable outcome on their nuclear and missile challenge. I'd be pushing back harder against Russia in Europe in particular, to some extent in the Middle East. So, you know, I would be re-entering things like the Paris Climate Agreement, because even though it's not an immediate crisis, it's a long-term crisis, but by the time it emerges, it's too late to do much about it, so we need to start dealing with it. Now, so I've got a pretty long agenda of things I would do, but they all require American involvement and a degree of American leadership.
Rather than withdrawing from some of these transnational agreements like the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Let's talk about the TPP in particular, because there's an interesting facet you provide here that some of the countries we're talking about that are in the TPP already have barrier-free access to our market. Is that right?
Absolutely. So, you know, the big losers from this in the short run are American exporters. And I think I'm surprised, actually, that they haven't made more of a fuss about it than they have, because they're gonna pay a price when they can't get their goods into Vietnam or some other places. So, and also, it was a real opportunity to set a model for what a modern trade agreement should be. It wasn't perfect, but it was an improvement over anything else that existed. And then it would force China to basically conclude that if China wanted to be a full-fledged part of the region economically, which it wants to, it would have had to come up to these higher rules. And that would have been good. And then TPP 2.0 or 3.0 could have set more demanding rules again and again. So by not participating here, I actually think we're hurting ourselves significantly, not just economically, but also strategically.
Is there are people missing something? It seems like one of the major points of the foreign policy realists like yourself is to accept the fact that you're not going to get everything on the first go round. But it seems like we live in a world today where if people don't get what, I mean, we're talking about this in Congress too. I mean, domestically as well as internationally, that if you don't get, you know, your position the first time, you're just walking away from it.
Yeah, you have to be prepared. You're going to get hammered. You know, the spirit of compromise, shall we say, particularly in domestic politics, is somewhere in remission. So you're going to be criticized if you don't get everything. And the answer is you won't. We're dealing with independent actors out there. So, for example, if we were to sit down with the North Koreans, there's zero chance they are going to agree to get rid of all of their nuclear weapons and their missiles. They're just not. So to set ourselves up for that, to demand that, is to set ourselves up for failure. So, but it would mean entering into an agreement with them where at best we'd get maybe half a loaf. If we were lucky, we would get a freeze on their testing program. Okay, it's not perfect, but it's a hell of a lot better than what we have, and it's a hell of a lot better than the alternative of going to war or seeing North Korea continue with an unlimited nuclear and missile program. But if the administration were going to do something like that, they would have to be prepared for the criticism. And in some ways, they've made the problem tough on themselves because they've articulated goals that there's no way on God's green earth they're going to meet.
Meaning a nuclear-free North Korea?
Absolutely.
Let's take a call here. Grumpy John on the line from Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Richard Haass, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, author of A World in Disarray. Hi, John.
Thanks very much, Jeffrey. Sir, the Trans-Pacific Partnership allows for an unelected three-judge panel to overrule our constitutional laws and can nullify our environmental protections and our economic protections. And I think that the TPP, unless it gets rid of that requirement that our laws can be overruled by a 4-3 panel unelected judge, is verging on the treasonous. I would like your comments on why you could possibly endorse such a violation of the sovereignty of the United States. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John. And we hear that from left and right, Richard. What is the truth there?
Look, any trade agreement is going to have a dispute settlement mechanism, whether it's the WTO, TPP, or anything else. There's obviously going to be moments when the parties are going to claim that one or another is acting inconsistently with what they signed up to. So the question is, then you have to have some mechanism for resolving it. And if in the WTO, which is the precedent we have, we actually win far more than we lose. But if we lose, we can ignore the ruling and others can introduce penalties against us. So it's a sovereign decision to enter these agreements. Then when the rulings take place, every sovereign member of these agreements have to decide how they're going to act. Judges can't force you to do things. It may mean, though, if you refuse to do them on a particular occasion, you have to pay a price for it. And I would simply say you've got to weigh that price against the costs and benefits of being a party to the agreement to begin with.
No, so there's no international regulatory order or regime or world police are going to come into your country and say, okay, you got to stop that now.
No, there's no enforcement type thing here. No one's compelling us to be a member. We obviously chose not to be a member of the TPP. Something like Paris, for example, the climate change agreement, the United States set its own ceilings. We said, here's where we want to be in terms of emissions. We had the right to modify that. If we wanted to give ourselves a less demanding schedule, we could have. Instead, we pulled out. That's ridiculous. It was a form of multilateralism that we should and could have embraced. So again, this idea that there's these supranational forces that are going to destroy or eat at American sovereignty, it's not true. In every one of these instances, we have the right to join. We have the right to depart. We have the right to disagree with specific decisions. And we may choose on occasion to do so, believing that the consequences would be worth living with. So this idea that somehow multinationalism or multilateralism is at odds with American sovereignty just doesn't bear scrutiny.
I want to talk, Richard Haass, about Russia specifically. I mean, because you get the sense that the humiliation of one man about the demise of the Soviet Union became the basis for the worldview of an entire country. But obviously, millions of people shared that worldview with him.
Absolutely. And I think what Putin is good at is tapping into this sense of Russian pride and Russian resentment after the end of the Cold War, essentially the Soviets lost. Then you had the dissolution of the Soviet Union itself. Then you had such things as NATO enlargement. So what Putin is able to do is essentially be something of a Russian nationalist, a Russian patriot, and tap into this like any good politician. So he hasn't delivered political reform, to say the least. If anything, it's been backwards. He hasn't delivered economic reform. The Russian economy almost totally depends upon the price of oil and gas. But he has restored Russian pride, and he's able to target resentment. So he's still phenomenally successful as he heads into yet another election, which, shall we say, will not be a cliffhanger.
Right. Whether the resentment reaches fever pitch or not, I mean, we're talking about NATO's involvements with Russia, and essentially, I mean, how should Russia feel about having America's buddies right next door?
Well, I think history will continue to debate the wisdom of NATO enlargement. And there'll be those who say, thank God we did it. If we hadn't done it, we'd have more Ukrainians, because Ukraine was never included in NATO. And there'll be those who'll say it was a terrible mistake. It led to the alienation of post-Soviet Russia. And, now we have essentially a new Cold War. So it's interesting. People always think that history and hindsight are 20/20. And my sense is this will be a debate that will just continue and continue and continue.
I guess one of the things that was most surprising in your section about Russia is the idea that Putin is actually less checked in his power than the leaders of the Soviet Union.
Quite definitely. The Soviet Union, you had institutions. Whatever else communism was, it was bureaucratic. And you had a Politburo. And you had, again, competing institutions there, not just an individual personality, except maybe for Stalin. Putin has essentially deinstitutionalized his country, and it's run by Putin and a bunch of cronies, and there's the total commingling of political and economic wealth and power. And so if tomorrow he wanted to do what he did vis-a-vis Ukraine, he wanted to do that with another country, I'm not sure there's anyone in Russia who could or would stop him.
We talked about Russian nationalism, but I guess one of the things that fascinates me the most in the world right now, our guest is Richard Haass from the Council on Foreign Relations, is the idea that people are dividing themselves in what seem to be smaller and smaller groups. You know, I'm not just Sudanese, I'm South Sudanese. You know, I'm not that kind of person, I'm this kind of person. And so everybody seems to want a homeland for themselves. What drives this is the big question.
It's a good question. I think about it, too, because it seems somewhat contradictory. Here we are, we're more global than ever, and that might be the answer, that as globalization is a reality and a lot of people find that they're battling forces that are hard to resist, so they anchor themselves in certain identities, and I think we've seen it, say, because of job loss that people associate with globalization, even when it's probably technology or immigration. Ideas come across borders. I think it's the way to, again, maintain identity, maintain a sense of what is familiar amidst a world of tremendous dynamism and change.
Well, the subtitle for the paperback edition of A World in Disarray is American Foreign Policy and the Crisis of the Old Order. What should some of the elements of a new order look like, do you think?
Well, what I talk about is that we keep the basic idea of this is a world still divided into sovereign countries. I still think we need American leadership, but my idea is that we need to have a world organized around what I call sovereignty or sovereign obligation or World Order 2.0, where we not just think of sovereignty as a question of rights and non-interference, but also obligation, that all of us, to put it from the American point of view, we now have to worry about what goes on inside other people's territories, whether it's computer hackers or terrorists or governments that build missiles and nuclear weapons that could reach us or climate change. So we need a world where, yes, we continue to have sovereignty and everybody else does as well, but also there's got to be a sense that we can build bulwarks against what goes on in other countries, that those things can threaten us. And that's what we have to figure out how to wire.
That's a good thing to think about, because technologically we are essentially in each other's backyards, or certainly have the capability to be there. The book is called A World in Disarray. It's the paperback edition, subtitled American Foreign Policy and the Crisis of the Old Order. It is the work of Richard Haass, who's the president of the Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.